is a comedy. The hooting and the hollering back and forth with the arguing. Where you from, who you know, what you making, what kind of car you in. Seems as though you lost sight of what's important when depositing the checks into your bank account and you up out of poverty. Your values is in disarray, prioritizing horribly. Unhappy with the riches cause you're piss poor morally. Ignoring all prior advice and forewarning and we mighty full of ourselves.
Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. That was T.I. Live Your Life. Well, actually, I never listened to him before in my life until now, but it's his birthday today. So he's put that out there. We are we are celebrating every day. We celebrate those who were born on this day, and we talk about our day in history at the top of our 9 o'clock hour and many very serious subjects. And when musicians are born, we play their music. So there we are. Ashmai, was one thing we forgot about this day in history before we begin this conversation was on this day.
1962.
Sonny Liston, knocked out.
Floyd Patterson.
2 minutes in, right?
6 seconds.
2 minutes and 6 seconds in. All right, those of us who were alive then, I remember that fight, but we won't go there now. So we're going to spend this hour looking at the issues facing the United States on the international scene and what's happening internationally. In all seriousness, we saw what has happened in Kenya, and we're going to start there, Kenya and Somalia. We're going to talk about the United Nations, Iran, and the United States in the Western world. And we are going to take a look, if we can, at Syria as well, how all that fits in, because all of them are very connected. We are joined right now by Dr. Abdi Samatar, professor of geography at the University of Minnesota, president of the African Studies Association, which actually is having its annual conference this November in Baltimore. We look forward to that coming here. Suni Khalid, a veteran public radio journalist who's covered wars and situations throughout the Middle East and Africa. James Phillips is a senior research fellow in Middle Eastern Affairs at the Heritage Foundation. And Phyllis Bennis is with us once again, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, author of many books, including Ending the War in Afghanistan, A Primer, and all welcome. Good to have you with us.
Pleasure. Well, thank
you. Good to be with you.
And join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages and leave a message there or tweet us at Mark Steiner. That's Mark with a C, 410-319-8888. And I know, Abdi Samatar, you're only here for just a little bit, so let me start with you as we look at Kenya. We've been talking to a lot of people the last 2 days about Somalia and about the situation of Somalians in Kenya, which we'll come to in a minute. But one of the reports we keep hearing over and over again is about Somali immigrant communities across the United States and elsewhere being kind of targets of Shabaab for recruiting. Dear friends of mine who were part of the Somali community have said that their relatives have been talked to by al-Qaeda and others about joining the cause, and there's been battles within families. Talk about that situation, why, and what's your analysis of all that?
Good morning to your
good
listeners
morning.
As well. And I think it's very important to step back historically and see where al-Shabaab comes from before we can see when it became a terrorist organization and when it began to recruit people. Al-Shabaab was a very small fragment of the militias of the what was then called the Union of the Islamic Courts, which sort of liberated Mogadishu from the warlord tyranny in 2006. And then shortly thereafter, our government here in the United States under President Bush and Dr. Rice as the National Security Advisor decided that this group who controls Mogadishu now at that point in time were Islamic terrorists and basically sort of in cahoots with the Ethiopian government at that point in time, allowed Ethiopia to invade Somalia on Christmas Day 2006. The Somali people, after the city of Mogadishu was heavily bombarded and about a million people were displaced by that bombardment, decided to resist the Ethiopian occupation. And this small fragment of the Union of the Islamic Courts militia became some of the gadflies in that resistance. And ultimately, it's that which gave birth to what we call al-Shabaab today. So that's the history. Al-Shabaab's history is so woven hand and glove, if you like, with our policies in the Horn of Africa, and particularly in Somalia. And between 2006 and 2008, al-Shabaab was not listed in the U.S. terrorist list as a terrorist organization. Only after 2008, I think it was the spring of 2008, where it was dubbed as such. And so many Somalis from all over the world were supporting the resistance, Somali resistance to the Ethiopian occupation. And it was, I think, at that point in time that many young men particularly were caught up in that sort of a nationalist flavor to get rid of the Ethiopian scourge in Somalia. But later on, as that war continued and as the Ethiopians were weakened, Shabab became the most important, if you like, or the strongest faction in what used to be the Union of the Islamic Courts.
And Phyllis Bennis, please, before we jump back into what's happening here at the moment, especially with the things we've been talking about, what's your analysis of what's happening to Somalia and Kenya?
Well, you know, I think that what we're seeing in Kenya is clearly, as we just heard, a spillover, if you will, from the crisis, the longstanding crisis in Somalia, where outside forces have brought that country to ruin after, you know, of so many years. And I think that, you know, it's been sort of astonishing watching the horrific reports from Nairobi coming in, but also realizing how different the coverage is in a situation like this, where it's very immediate. It's at the top of the news for days as it goes forward. I was struck by the parallel. The New York Times, the Washington Post, and NPR all had big feature pieces by their reporters based in Nairobi talking about how this was different, how personal it felt. And I was struck by the degree to which how much attention gets paid to a horrific attack like this is so tied up with how many Westerners may have been among the victims, as well as the wealthiest of Kenyans. You know, in Kenya, in other places in Africa, these kinds of attacks, even at this level, have happened before. This is not the first time. But it's covered so differently because the target, and maybe this was part of the rationale of the al-Shabaab terrorists who made this decision about where to attack, maybe they were figuring that if they attack the centerpiece of kind of wealth and Western presence in Nairobi, they're more likely to get more attention. I have no idea, but that certainly could be the case. But it was the case that the press coverage of it was qualitatively different as a result of the nature of the target. And I think it's, you know, it's just something that we need to keep thinking about when we hear in the U.S. about the so-called global war on terror. President Obama yesterday at the U.N. talking about the absolute right of the U.S. to use military force to protect our core interests and to protect our people. It's people in the rest of the world who face the realities of terrorist attacks on a far more regular, far more brutal basis than we ever have here. And I think it's just something that a situation like this, where we see that the vast disparity of coverage, that it brings that back to what we're facing here.
Now, let me go to Abdi again, then go over to Suni before we bring in James, just because Abdi only has a couple more minutes with us. And Abdi, I'd like to hear what were your thoughts about what Phyllis just said and about the symbolism of this attack and more.
I think Phyllis is absolutely right on the dot, and what we have not heard much about in the coverage in this instance, as brutal and cruel and callous it was, is that the Kenyan military itself occupying Somalia illegally, parts of Somalia illegally, over the last 2 years, have actually killed more Somalis, several times more Somalis, civilian Somalis in that country as it struggles with al-Shabaab, then has been sort of killed by al-Shabaab in this most recent event. This is not to say, therefore, al-Shabaab is justified. Absolutely not. But there are different kinds of criminalities that are taking place. And as Phil said, only some of them attract the kind of attention that the world has been exposed to over the last few days, which is max of the injustice in this whole bloody war called the War on Terror, that there are certain lives that are worth more than human lives, and other human lives that are sort of a debased to be less than a human life. So they are part of the collateral damage as we do sort of our knee-jerk reactions all over the world. So I think that's the one point to be made. The second point to be made is that if President Kenyatta is wise enough, I think he will think twice about sort of the kind of a rhetoric he's using. Certainly, he needs to defend his people. Certainly, he needs to sort of get rid of Shabab in whatever form it's in Kenya. But he has to also understand that his own troops are in Somalia, supposedly under the African Union force called AMISOM, and is using that to leverage influence inside Somalia. So many Somalis watch this very carefully, what he's doing in Somalia, and say, how is this different from an illegal occupation by a foreign sovereign in our country, and how can he have legitimacy then to talk about terrorism when, in fact, he's using force to get his licks in Somalia in a country that's not his. And this has serious consequences for livelihoods in Somalia and, much more importantly, for political stability that's slowly emerging from that war-torn country.
Sunny, you want to jump in before I want to kind of ask another question about what this means in depth, but go ahead.
Yeah, one of the things that I wanted to mention to Abdi and Phyllis, I was at the U.S. Embassy in Kenya in 1982. I was an intern there, and my wife is a Kenyan Somali, and I've gotten very, very close with the Somali community. But there's been almost no reporting at all about the Kenyan Somalis and the Somalis at all. There is a, Abdi and I were talking about this before, there's a huge debate among Somalis within the Somali community about the identity of the attackers, because they've been identified as some having British passports, Canadian passports, Swedish passports, and American passports. And this goes to this underlying problem that people have been speculating about, the issue of Somalis in the diaspora community being recruited by al-Shabaab for this kind of mayhem. And many of them, their ages, they were not even born in Somalia, but they have become radicalized in the West in these insular Somali communities in the diaspora, which is a concern for everybody, but I think it's especially a concern for the Somalis themselves. I'm concerned that with this attack by al-Shabaab, of the stigma that Somalis, all Somalis, will be under. I have a son, my older son, Hassan, who's 23 years old, and Abdi has met him before. It looks like he just stepped off the plane from Hargeisa. But if he were to visit his relative,
which is in Somalia.
It's a Somali land, northern right. Somalia. But if he were to go back to Kenya today to visit his relatives with an American passport looking like he looks and with his name, I would not be at all surprised if he were to be detained. There is a huge stigma, and there is a crisis that has been going on within the Somali community that I don't think has been given a proper or even enough mention at all, and it's nowhere in any of the coverage.
Well, let me ask you this question. Let me kind of switch gears here. I know that Dr. Samathra has to leave here in about 5 or 6 minutes, and I want to get you back in before you have to leave. But let me throw this question out to start with James Phillips and go to Abdi and then Phyllis about – some people would argue, especially the way what you described earlier, Phyllis, and what you described, Dr. Samathra, that what we're doing here, James Phillips, is the war in Syria, given the support of the Americans and Israelis of Kenya, is part of this gigantic proxy war taking place in the Middle East.
Well, I think it is part of a larger struggle, and I would point out that the Kenyan government is working with the Somalian government against Shabaab. And yes, it's a shame that the international media doesn't focus on Shabaab's terrorist attacks inside Somalia against Somalians as much as it focuses on its attacks on innocent people outside Somalia. And I wish it would cover more of the suicide bombings against mosques and the repression of Somalians by the
Somalis.
Shabaab. But I think part of the problem is Shabaab and its allies have tried to drive out the Western media as well as Western humanitarian aid workers and doctors that are trying to help the civilian population in order to consolidate its control. And I think losing effort inside Somalia has provoked it to try to kind of reset its support and reset its strategy by engaging in much more much more of a focus on external attacks. And I think that the foreign militants that flock to help these groups in Somalia tend to be much more radical, and some inspired by Al-Qaeda. And I would expect to see more of these type attacks in the future.
But they're being radicalized in the West.
That's true. I think there's a kind of a siren song, especially over the Internet, for young Muslims that are outside their home countries. And we saw this also in Iraq and in Palestine, where refugee camps provided support for some of the most radical groups. And I think we're seeing that possibly happening in the future in Kenya, but also in the West.
And I know, Abdi, you have to leave in a few minutes. I want to get back to Phyllis here on this issue. But, Abdi, could you take us to break here with your thoughts on whether this is a proxy war or not and how that's defined?
I believe that it's a proxy war. I mean, the global war on terrorist strategy is not only to use American forces where needs be, but also to use others. And I think Kenya is positioned. I mean, there a few years back, they used to talk about the four anchor states in Africa in our geostrategic deals with Africa, South Africa and Southern Africa, Nigeria and West Africa, Egypt and North Africa, and Ethiopia in East Africa. So there was this contestation whether Ethiopia or Kenya is the appropriate one. But what I know is that there used to be, I don't know whether it's still there, a sort of a hidden base of some sort for the intelligence community of our country in the northern coast of Kenya, watching Somalia. But I don't think need that anymore. They have one at the airport in Mogadishu, which others have written about. And so the tragedy is, I think, more Somalis have been killed by Al-Shabaab and brutalized by Al-Shabaab than all of the other victims from everywhere else in the world put together. I think the latter number will be a fraction of the first one, maybe a 1% or something of that nature. Kenya is not concerned about that because Kenyan troops have themselves been killing Somali civilians in their operations in Kenya. And President Kenyatta or President Kibaki never spoke about that, or no Kenyan who is responsible about that. And so those peoples are sort of a secondary. So I think the proxy war is what's happening in Somalia. Ethiopia intervenes when it wants with our blessings and with our money. Kenyans have done that, and others will do the same thing. And so as long as that kind of a mindset is operating in that part of the world, then you can bet we can expect the Shabaab-like reactions to these problems. I think the best thing the Western world can do, particularly the United States, is to put money into the development of a professional Somali security force. That, in my opinion, will chase those Al-Shabaab-like characters into the sea within a year. But we have not been able to do that. We have been pumping hundreds of millions of dollars on what's called AMISOM, the African Union force in Somalia. And unfortunately, except in few spaces like Mogadishu, they have not been able to hack the challenges of Al-Shabaab in the rest of the country.
Dr. Abdi Samatar, Professor of Geography at the University of Minnesota and President of the African Studies Association nationally, thank you so much for being with us. We look forward to having you back again soon.
With pleasure.
And Phyllis Bennis, could you talk to this? I mean, I really think that one of the things we don't really get into, which I'm pushing here a little bit, which is this the idea that what we're seeing, whether it's in Somalia and in the African policies of the West, what's happening in Syria, what's happened in Libya, what's happened in so many other countries, the civil war in Sudan in some ways as well, are all part of this battle between international interests, including the United States, China, Russia, over control of resources and more, and your analysis of that?
Well, I think we have to be careful not to lead everything into one giant similarity, if you will.
Okay.
I've written quite extensively about Syria, that there are really five, at least, separate wars underway in Syria, one of which, of course, is a massive and brutal civil war between the regime and a large part of the population. But the others are a global war between the U.S. and Russia over sea lanes and dominance and other things, a regional war for power largely between Iran and Saudi Arabia, but with Turkey and Qatar involved as well, a sectarian war between Sunni and Shia, with the Alawites in Syria coming in on the Shia side, and the war between the U.S. and Israel versus Iran over the nuclear question. So all of these wars are being played out in Syria to the last Syrian. So in a sense, you can argue that they're a kind of proxy war, but they are much more grounded in the reality of that war itself. And I think that it's for that reason that we need, in the case of Syria certainly, massive international engagement, not only to deal with the crisis of chemical weapons, whoever used them, and we should be clear that we still don't have clarity on who used them, despite the claims of the U.S. that they know. If they know, let us see the evidence. We still haven't seen it. And the U.N. report is far from clear on that question. But the real need, the urgent need, is for international diplomacy. I mean, I think it's for that reason that the current moves between the U.S. and Russia to rejoin talks that could lead to a kind of Geneva II diplomatic process becomes so important. In some of these cases, it really needs to be diplomacy that's grounded solely in the internal situation between factions, between the government versus the opposition, that sort of thing. In Syria, that's certainly not the case, because there are these global and regional forces that are at war as well. So I think in each of these cases, we have to look at it very carefully. I do think that the question in a place like Somalia, I think Abdi knows far more than I do about the internal situation there, but I would want to know a great deal more before saying that a better solution in terms of the security of Somalia would be to abandon the UN mission and instead move directly to some version of direct U.S. sponsorship of a new Somali security force. In the past, that has created far more problems than it has solved, and I would be skeptical at best, let's say, that that would be the answer, but that's certainly the kind of discussion that needs to be going forward, and we're not hearing that. What we are hearing is that increasingly U.S. policy across Africa is a militarized policy being implemented not through the State Department, not through diplomacy, not through foreign service officers, but directly through the military, that AFRICOM, the Africa Command of the Pentagon, has become the dominant instrument of U.S. foreign policy in Africa. And that is clearly and directly linked to the question of resources. In 2007, U.S. imports of oil shifted between, for the first time, the U.S. began to import more oil from Africa as a whole on the continental level than it did from the Middle East as a whole. And while U.S. Imports of foreign oil are going down in general anyway, the U.S. is still pulling in more from Africa than from Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, et cetera, in the Middle East. That's not something you can separate out, nor can you separate out the role of China in Africa, which is playing a major economic role in the continent, and the competition between the U.S. And China for economic domination remains a key component of U.S. policy in the region, so that, again, the interest of Africans is simply not high on the agenda.
I think that, you know, the complexity you just laid out, Phyllis Bennis, and how you ended it is exactly where it is in many ways. I think that we what happens in Africa in terms of controlling resources, who does it, the Africans are not kept in mind, that this is African nations are not kept in mind, and you're seeing this increasingly right now. I read a report the other night about increasing Chinese presence in Khartoum and Sudan, and negotiations about more pressure given what just happened in Kenya. So you see that playing out on multiple levels in Eritrea and other places as well that we never talk about here.
And one of the things that you see when you go to West Africa is you see the Chinese everywhere. When I was in Liberia, I was sort of astounded to see that the Chinese were repaving roads and rebuilding everything. They were building the railroad. The Chinese have a huge presence throughout Africa.
We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we're going to leap into what's going on in the United Nations between Iran and the United States bring our other guest, James Phillips, right back in the conversation to opening comment on that. Reminding you to join me this Sunday at 2 p.m. at the Radical Book Fair Pavilion at the Baltimore Book Festival, where I'll be moderating a discussion between Garl Alperovitz, Dr. Lester Spence, and Maryland State Senator Jamie Raskin. We'll be looking at Garl's book, What Then Must We Do, and ask difficult questions about our economy, corporate capitalism, and alternatives for the 21st century. So join us there at 2 p.m. this Sunday. More information at BaltimoreBookFestival.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and that was Womack and Womack, Baby, I'm Scared of You. It's Cecil Womack was born on this day, so we're playing his songs, some of the songs during the break. Romani, on the way back to the conversation that the Mark Steiner Show here in Maryland is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. Money comes back in the end, and it belongs to you. More information at www.mecu.com. And we are here in the rest of this, for the next 15, 20 minutes, with SUNY Khaled, veteran public radio journalist who's covered wars throughout the Middle East and Africa, James Phillips, senior research fellow for the Middle Eastern Affairs at Heritage Foundation, and Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, author of many books, including Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan, a primer. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. And James, well, let's open up with what's going on at the UN right now, in terms of what it means that this kind of overture of sorts is taking place between Iran and the United States. The two men did not shake hands. Both of them didn't want to shake hands. It wasn't just one, according to reports. So tell me, begin with your analysis of that before we turn to Phyllis.
Well, I think there's a dance of the seven veils going on and a kind of a diplomatic minuet at the UN. And I think President Rouhani made the minimum possible outreach he could make in order to point a contrast with his predecessor, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. And he told Iranians before he left for the UN that he was going to present a new face for Iranian diplomacy. And in a sense, Ahmadinejad set such a low bar that I think he did succeed in presenting that new face. But the question is, how serious is he in making the necessary compromises to advance a diplomatic solution of this nuclear standoff over Iran's nuclear weapons program? And he was clear to say that he would not jeopardize what he considered to be the right of Iranians to enrich uranium. And from the beginning, that's been the real problem. So I think those that expected a quick resolution of this problem were not only disappointed at the UN, but they're likely to be disappointed in the next few weeks and months of grueling diplomatic talks.
Phyllis?
Well, I see it, not surprisingly, quite differently. I think that the question of Iran's rights are written in the Non-Proliferation Treaty, of which Iran has been a longstanding member, which we should note Israel, of course, is not, which is why Israel's
They're ambiguous.
Weapons,
They're ambiguous.
Sorry?
They're ambiguous, Phyllis.
Ambiguous, right. We all know that the strategic ambiguity is a great term. That's the really unfortunate part is that the U.S. has accepted strategic ambiguity at the request of the Israelis to not acknowledge the 200 to 400 high-density nuclear bombs in the Dimona plant, some of which may be getting so old that they're a threat just environmentally. But that aside, what we're seeing from from the Iranian side is in a certain way not new. You know, the position that Iran will never build a nuclear weapon, a fatwa, all of this, has been talked about before. In general, it's dismissed out of hand by mainstream media and U.S. officials as either irrelevant, of course it's not true, it can't be true, fatwas can change, all of that, but ignoring the real significance, which is the political question. You know, Rouhani and the Supreme Leader, for that matter, ultimately have to answer to their population. The problems with the election in 2009, since the revolution, was an unusual one in the sense that there was so much distortion in that election. That hasn't been the case usually, and it wasn't this time around. Rouhani was elected specifically to deal with the question of sanctions and to deal with the question of the nuclear standoff. I think that what we're looking at here is a scenario in which it was a very significant change in President Obama's opinion, President Obama's speech, when he referenced that Iran has the right to access nuclear power for peaceful terms. Now, that wasn't a full acknowledgement of what the MPT actually says. The MPT goes beyond access and calls for, quote, the inalienable right of all the parties to the treaty to develop research, production, and use of nuclear energy for peaceful purposes without discrimination. So Iran is entitled to those rights. That's not something new. And, of course, while President Obama referred only to the Iranian government's responsibilities under the MPT and said nothing about its rights under the treaty, but recognizing it, talking about the treaty in this context, is a major shift for the U.S., and I think a very positive one. I think that both sides are moving towards wanting to resolve this crisis diplomatically. It's having a devastating impact on people in Iran. The sanctions are crippling people, as has happened in so many other places where nationwide sanctions have been imposed, not sanctions that actually identify and limit their impact to individuals or specific institutions involved. So there is a real urgency, and I think the Syria crisis has brought this out. There's a new possibility because of the pullback from the military brink in Syria, and the possibility of seeing a whole new globally engaged diplomacy around Syria that will have to involve Iran, although that wasn't discussed either at the UN, that's going to set the stage for much greater possibilities for diplomacy on resolving the issue between Iran and the United States. President Obama went quite far in certain ways. He talked about, he recognized Iran's interests as legitimate. He spoke of Iran with respect. He talked about how Iranian mistrust of the U.S. has, quote, deep roots, and he even referenced in particular those roots going back to the U.S. role in the overthrow of the Iranian government, referencing, of course, the overthrow of Mossadegh in 1953. And it was interesting because when he talked about it, he put that coup, the U.S.-backed coup of 1953, in the context of the Cold War. Now, you can argue that it's a bit disingenuous. It was really a response by the British and the U.S. to Mossadegh's nationalization of Iranian oil, far more than it was specifically about Iran's potential relationship with the Soviet Union. But nonetheless, the fact that he put it in that context, I read as a way of distancing himself from that history. Yes, we did that, but it was in another era. It was a consequence of another set of political realities. And therefore, the implication is, that's not me, that's not my administration, that's not the policy of the U.S. today. That, I thought, was very important.
I think what we've seen this week, I would agree with what Phyllis said. I think what we've seen this week are the sort of the death throes of the policy of dual containment of yesteryear, where you had to contain a hostile Iraq under Saddam Hussein and a hostile Iran under successive leaders. I think that the Iranians and the Americans are ultimately destined to cooperate much more productively than have conflict. After having visited Iran and talking with Iranians, there is a wellspring, I think, for that. that confrontation is not in the best interest of either nation. I also think that there, you know, it's like cooking. What are the two things you need in cooking? You need ingredients and you need timing. Timing is all there is. And I think with Ahmadinejad, it sort of delayed the inevitable, that there's going to have to be a reckoning, that Americans and Iranians are going to have to sit across the table and work out their differences. I am much more hopeful about that now. I think that Syria has indeed accelerated it. And I also think that the Iranians are also looking at the American political calendar, that Obama has 3 years left in office, that they may not have a chance or an opportunity for a better deal with the administration in the future, and that perhaps the time is now to seize it.
James?
Well, I would agree that the U.S. and Iran could solve this problem if both followed their national interests. However, I think the regime in Tehran is a very narrowly based Islamist totalitarian regime that has staked its ideological credibility on unceasing opposition to the U.S., the Great Satan. And by Great Satan, they mean that not only is the U.S. evil, but it is tempting Iranian youth away from what they see as pure Islam, which is one reason why Ayatollah Khomeini said he feared American universities more than the U.S. Marines, which is one reason why Iran's surrogate terrorists, the Hezbollah, were holding hostage American university professors in American University Beirut back in the 80s and 90s. And this means that the supreme leader, who constantly rails against the danger of a soft war or a velvet revolution, is adamantly opposed to any improvement in relations with the U.S. because he sees that, I think correctly, as undermining his ideological base, because this regime has brought very little except for misery and economic disaster, international isolation to the Iranian people, and I think they're fed up with it.
I think they're well aware of that, and I think I sense a more pragmatism coming from them. The sanctions have done their job, and I think one of the reasons that you're seeing this opening, that it's there, is that there's a reality that the policies in the past have not redounded to the favor of the religious leadership, Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei.
Phyllis, but it seems like I think the complexities in both societies are playing, have a role in what this means. And I think that sometimes we often kind of have very narrow interpretations of what the politics of the internal politics of a country like Iran are.
Absolutely. And I think that the legacy of demonization against Iran for 30 years, the fact that the U.S. has not had diplomatic relations, doesn't have good information about what's going on inside the country. One of the most important things I would say, actually, about this week's development, certainly culminating yesterday at the UN, but even in the last few days, sort of in the run-up to that, has been a quiet abandonment of the, quote, no-contact policy that was operative in the State Department at least since 2007, and that was only a one-off disruption of it. It had gone on for much longer, where basically top-level U.S. officials were simply prohibited from meeting with or talking to their Iranian counterparts. That can't ever be good. That can't ever lead. I mean, if you look back at the Cold War, the U.S. was in constant communication with the Soviet Union at every level, top to bottom. And while people around the world paid the price in very hot wars throughout the Cold War, there wasn't a global war during that period, and much of that was because there was that level of communication. So I think that what we're seeing is a greater pragmatism on both sides. The Obama administration has made clear that the longstanding view of a number of U.S.-based hawks at the Heritage Foundation and elsewhere, a bunch of Israeli hawks, a bunch of pro-Israeli lobbyists and others, who have claimed that the only solution is to demand that Iran give up all nuclear enrichment, That's a deal breaker. That's just not going to happen. And this was clearly an acknowledgement that that's not the requirement that's now on the table. So it's a kind of pragmatism that's come to Washington, as well as very clearly a much more pragmatic approach in Tehran that won out in the last election.
Dual containment is dead.
Well, I want to thank all of you for being. This is really fascinating. That Phyllis Bennett is director of the New Internationalist Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. SUNY College veteran, public radio journalist, James James, senior research fellow for Middle Eastern Affairs at the Heritage Foundation. Thank you all so much for your time today.
Thank you.
We're going to take a very brief break and come right back with Jessica Dibbs looking at breathing and our health. Stay with us.